After a stint at Small's Jazz Club in 2006, Israeli-American jazz bassist and composer and bandleader Omer Avital decided that the band should do an all-day live recording session, and this tune, Song for Peace, was one of many that came out of it. It appears on his 2012 album, Suite of the East. Daniel Friedman on drums, Joel Fromm on sax, Omer Klein on piano, and Avishai Cohen on trumpet. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and we're going to have a pretty intense session today because we'll be talking about the Israel lobby and U.S. policy, an extremely lopsided power arrangement. But before I do that, I want to announce and remind you that this is the week. On Sunday, this coming Sunday, I'll be speaking at the Community Church of New York at 1:30 p.m. It's at 40 East 35th Street in Manhattan, just off of Park Avenue. So I'm looking forward to seeing many, many faces that I've only heard. I've only heard your faces. So let's get to actually see each other's faces on Sunday coming. Well, the 2018 policy conference of the innocuously named American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, ends tomorrow in Washington, D.C. A list of strategic policy objectives will soon be announced, I'm sure, as having been accomplished. And there'll be nothing innocuous about that. AIPAC wants it known that, once again, the juggernaut lobbying organization pulled through for Israel and for Jews all over the world. And once again, the United States is almost single-handedly footing the wish list bill. Many Middle East experts, however, are sensing a storm brewing against the lopsided power arrangement between Israel and the United States, especially as it applies to billions of dollars in aid. It is way past time to revise the formula, they say, but we've been hearing this for quite some time. What is this power arrangement? And how did it come to be? What is the reason that we have a gathering of thousands of people who essentially are lobbyists and in support of policies that are advantageous to Israel? But the bottom line is it all rests on U.S. taxpayer dollars being given in the form of, quote, aid, unquote. It is a topic that needs to be discussed. So we're starting it here today, and we're starting it with a talk given by John Mearsheimer, University of Chicago professor and co-author of Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. He's going to be talking about how the lobby has changed since the original publication of the book that he co-authored with Stephen Walt, and the future of the lobby under the new administration. So we are going to hear him give his assessment, and it is not the only one that we will hear. We will hear many more over time. But let us say that we are sufficiently aware, most of us, that this is a very touchy subject. And just the same, it needs to be talked about. The questions arise, is this a lobbying organization? Should it be permitted to do what it does? Is it overreaching? Is it actually meddling in the formulation of U.S. foreign and domestic policy? Is it actually making U.S. foreign and domestic policy? What gives this organization, AIPAC, the authority to do this? Or is it just simply that people are a little taken aback by an organization that perhaps is being far more aggressive than most in lobbying government, in seeking the kind of help, specifically the kind of help that it wants for its people and the nation of Israel? Or is it that there's something else happening here and it has been allowed to happen over and over and over again, and with increasing reach into the innermost sanctuaries of government? AIPAC, we should keep in mind, is a pro-Israel lobby group, and they make no apologies about that. That's what they're formed to do, and they were founded 55 years ago with the same mission, to see to the interests of Israel and the Jewish community worldwide. So let's take a listen to an assessment of where things stand. Professor Mearsheimer giving his assessment of AIPAC, where it stands, what it's doing, and why we ought to be very concerned about it. Let's listen.
Issue in 1982. So it's a special pleasure to introduce our first keynote speaker, Professor John Mearsheimer. He is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. In March of 2006, he and Professor Stephen Walt of Harvard published an article in the London Review of Books titled The Israel Lobby. The article had originally been commissioned by The Atlantic Monthly, but that American publication decided not to publish it after all. so instead it found a home overseas. The paper's publication caused an uproar, in no small part because it shed light on what AIPAC operative Steve Rosen described as a night flower that thrives in the dark and shrivels up in the sunlight. Harvard posted the paper on its website but removed its logo. And attacks on Mearsheimer and Walt ranged from naive, that from Noam Chomsky, to, and this will shock you, anti-Semites. The following year, their article evolved into the book The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, which has since been translated into 22 languages. Professor Mearsheimer, by the way, will be signing copies of his book at 12:15 at the registration table where he signed in. I'm also particularly glad that he is joining us today because every year people ask us if he is going to be speaking at our conference. So it's been a great pleasure this year to be able to say, of course he is. Today he will be discussing what, if anything, has changed in the decades since the Israel Lobby was published. Please join me in welcoming Professor John Mearsheimer.
Thank you for the kind introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here today to speak before this distinguished audience. I would like to thank IRMEP and the Washington Report for inviting me to give this talk. Of course, I thank all of you for coming out to hear me and the other speakers. I would like to focus my talk on what has transpired regarding the Israel lobby and the U.S.-Israeli relationship in the 10 years since Steve Walt and I wrote The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. My talk's comprised of four parts. I'll begin by briefly restating the core arguments in our book. I'll then describe four major changes that have taken place regarding the lobby and the U.S.-Israeli relationship over the past decade. I will then describe what has not changed and conclude by speculating about the future. The central argument in the book is that the United States has a special relationship with Israel that has no parallel in modern history, and it is almost wholly due to the lobby. What makes Israel's relationship with the United States extraordinary is not simply the fact that Israel has received more foreign aid than any other country, or that Washington almost always backs Israel diplomatically. What makes it truly special is that the aid is given unconditionally. In other words, Israel gets this aid even when it does things that the United States opposes, like building settlements in the West Bank. This discussion raises the obvious question: why does the United States give Israel so much aid and without any conditions? Israel's supporters sometimes argue that it is because Israel is a vital strategic asset. This is not a serious argument. In fact, giving Israel nearly unconditional support is one of the reasons we have a terrorism problem. Others argue that there's a moral rationale for the special relationship. Israel is said to be a democracy that shares our values. The two countries certainly share some values, but Israel is a Jewish state which clearly privileges its Jewish citizens. Non-Jews are second-class citizens in both theory and practice. The United States, on the other hand, is a liberal democracy that works hard to treat all of its citizens equally. It certainly is not a Christian state that treats non-Christians as second-class citizens. Indeed, that kind of discrimination, which is part of Israel's essence, is antithetical to the American way of life. Furthermore, Israel's treatment of the Palestinians in the occupied territories is sharply at odds with U.S. values. Finally, there's the claim that the American people have such a favorable view of Israel that they demand their politicians back the special relationship. This argument, however, is not persuasive. If you look at the survey data on how the American public thinks about Israel, as Grant made clear before I spoke, there's no question that Americans have a generally favorable image of Israel, in part because media coverage tends to be favorable. But as poll after poll shows, that support is not especially deep or wide. So what explains the special relationship if there is no strategic or moral imperative, and if most Americans do not favor it? Our answer, of course, is the lobby. What exactly is the lobby? Steve and I argue that it's a loose coalition of individuals and groups who actively work to influence U.S. foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction. It's not a centralized organization, and the groups that make up the lobby do not agree on every issue. It includes organizations like AIPAC, the Anti-Defamation League, the Conference of Presidents, the Zionist Organization of America, and Christians United for Israel, just to name a few. It also includes think tanks like YNAP and the American Enterprise Institute, and publications like the Weekly Standard and Commentary. It certainly is not a cabal or a conspiracy that, quote unquote, controls U.S. foreign policy. Rather, it's a powerful interest group like the NRA, the Farm Lobby, the Cuba Lobby, or the AARP. And it operates pretty much the same way those other interest groups do. Very importantly, the lobby is not synonymous with Jewish Americans. Surveys suggest that about a third of American Jews do not care that much about Israel. Others do not support the lobby's positions, and some groups that work on Israel's behalf, such as the so-called Christian Zionists, are not Jewish. In short, the lobby is defined by its political agenda, not by ethnicity or religion. Finally, we argue that the lobby has pushed policies that are in neither Israel's or America's national interests. In particular, we maintain that it would have been much better for both countries if the United States had long ago pressured Israel to stop building settlements and allow for the creation of a viable Palestinian state. But this did not happen, and it will not happen, because the lobby makes it impossible for American leaders to use the leverage at their disposal to pressure Israel. In essence, that's the story Steve and I tell. Let me now switch gears and talk about what has changed regarding Israel and the lobby since the book was first published in 2007. I think that there have been four noteworthy changes. First, there has been a fundamental change in how Americans think and talk about Israel, the special relationship, and the lobby. When we initially wrote our book, there was much ignorance about these subjects. And my sense is that most people who read our book or who have read our book thought there was a large element of truth in what we said, but that we had nevertheless exaggerated the lobby's influence. There was also a great deal of ignorance in the American body politic about Israeli policies, especially toward the Palestinians, and little understanding of the special relationship. This is hardly surprising because one of the lobby's main goals is to prevent an open conversation in the media about Israeli policy, the U.S.-Israeli relationship, and the lobby itself. It was successful for a long time, but my sense from talking to many people about these matters and from closely following the public discourse is that those days are over. For example, it's commonplace, even in the mainstream media, to talk about the lobby using just that word. And I cannot tell you how many people have said to me that, if anything, Steve and I just scratched the surface in our discussion of the lobby's power and influence. I might add that there is now more discussion of Israel's policies and actions in the American media. And if you read the comments section that follow many newspaper stories, you will see that there are a substantial number of Americans who are critical of Israeli behavior, especially toward the Palestinians. And only someone who is blind and deaf would not recognize that the United States is deeply committed to defending Israel's behavior at almost every turn. In short, there is much more awareness of these critical issues today than there was a decade ago. What's caused this change? I think that our original article and the book helped. Both attracted an enormous amount of attention. Indeed, the lobby book made the New York Times bestseller list, and because of the internet, the article on which the book was based was widely read all over the world. But I think that ultimately our arguments would not have had much impact were it not for a number of other factors. First, the actions of Israel and the lobby over the past decade have done much to substantiate many of the claims we made in the book. Just to take one example, consider how Israel and the lobby responded to the Iran nuclear deal. Prime Minister Netanyahu went to extraordinary lengths to sabotage the agreement, going so far as to give a speech to a joint session of Congress on March 3, 2015, that not only sought to undermine the deal, but was also an indirect attack on President Obama. Of course, he was aided by AIPAC, which went all out to defeat the deal. This nasty fight between Netanyahu and the lobby on one hand and the Obama administration on the other hand played out in full public view. The second factor behind the increased awareness of Israeli policy and the lobby is the internet and social media. There are now all sorts of places on the internet one can go to for information about these subjects. The website Mondo Weiss, which I am sure everyone in this room knows about, is a case in point. It posts a steady stream of stories that reveal important information about Israeli policy and the lobby's activities, not to mention critical assessments of those matters. Mondo Weiss, which is now 11 years old, had 8 million visits to its site in 2016. Of course, there are other sites that provide valuable information, like the Electronic Intifada, which is run by Ali Abu Niba, and the site for the Israeli magazine Plus 972. Another important source of information on the internet is Haaretz, the liberal Israeli newspaper, which often runs pieces that take a critical perspective on Israel as well as the lobby. And in the age of Twitter, important pieces that appear on these sites are immediately spread around the world to huge numbers of people. These same pieces are also circulated on email lists that go to hundreds, if not thousands, of interested readers. Third, there are a host of organizations that are willing to criticize Israel and the lobby. IRMEP is a case in point, as it has played an important role in exposing the lobby's activities over time. There are also a number of organizations that are deeply committed to Israel, which nevertheless are willing to take Israel to task when they disapprove of its behavior. They include J Street, Jewish Voice for Peace, Americans for Peace Now, and the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, among others. Finally, there are some important voices in the mainstream media who have taken to speaking critically about Israeli policy and the lobby. The most important person in this regard is Peter Beinart, who wrote a very influential article in the June 2010 issue of the New York Review of Books entitled "The Failure of the American Jewish Establishment," which is critical of the lobby for aiding and abetting Israel's misguided policies in the occupied territories. He has continued to write and speak about these matters since this article appeared. And before Beinhart, there was the late Tony Judt, who offered searing criticisms of Israel and its American defenders. Of course, there are a number of other key figures in the mainstream media who have occasionally taken aim at both Israel and the lobby over the past decade. They would include Roger Cohen, Thomas Friedman, and Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times, as well as Jon Stewart of Daily Show fame. In sum, I think there has been a significant change in how Americans think and talk about Israel since our book appeared. The second big change is that Israel's image in the West, especially in the United States, has suffered serious damage over the past decade. This is due in part to the fact that information about Israel is more readily available now than it was in the past, thanks in good part to the internet and social media, but it is also a result of the fact that things have been changing inside of Israel in recent years. For starters, the political center of gravity in Israel has been moving steadily rightward for decades, and it has now reached the point where government ministers occasionally make racist comments about Palestinians and write legislation that is directly at odds with basic liberal values. The recent legislation banning individuals who support BDS from entering Israel is the latest example of this phenomenon. All indications are that this rightward shift will continue for the foreseeable future, and Israel will become an increasingly illiberal country, even towards its own citizens. But the key stain on Israel's reputation is its brutal treatment of the Palestinians and the fact that it has become an apartheid state. Until recently, Israel and its supporters were able to maintain the fiction that there would eventually be a legitimate Palestinian state living side by side with Israel. But it is now clear that there is virtually no chance that will happen, and Greater Israel is here to stay. And that Greater Israel, as Richard Falk and Virginia Tilley make clear in an important new UN study, is already an apartheid state. Israel and its defenders vehemently deny that fact, but even among Israelis, it's not unusual to hear Israel described in as apartheid state. For example, two former Israeli prime ministers, Ehud Barak and Ehud Olmert, have said that if there is no two-state solution, there will be, Israel will, to quote Olmert, face a South African-style struggle. Well, there is no two-state solution. Speaking of South Africa, there are a number of individuals who were well acquainted with the situation in that racist state before it collapsed, who believe that the situation in Israel is worse. John Duggard, the eminent South African law professor, says that the crimes against the Palestinians are, to quote him, infinitely worse than those committed by the apartheid regime in South Africa, end of quote. He is hardly the lone voice in that regard. For anyone who doubts how bad life can be for the Palestinians living under Israeli control, one only has to consider what happened in Israel's three major assaults against Gaza over the past decade: Operation Cast Lead, Operation Pillar of Defense, and Operation Protective Edge. Because of time constraints, I will focus exclusively on the first of those operations, Cast Lead, which took place in the weeks before President Obama was inaugurated in 2009. Israeli forces killed about 1,400 Palestinians, of whom roughly 1,200 were civilians. 350 of those civilians were children. In contrast, 13 Israelis were killed. The ratio of Palestinians to Israelis killed in that operation is 108-1. That's not a war in my lexicon. That's a massacre. I might add that 6,300 Palestinian homes were destroyed, contributing to the 600,000 tons of rubble that littered Gaza when the shooting ended. The UN commissioned an investigation in the wake of that conflict, which was headed by the distinguished South African jurist Richard Goldstone. The final report concluded that Israel had engaged in, quote, a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population, end of quote. It went on to accuse Israel of committing war crimes and possible crimes against humanity. There are other signs of serious trouble in Israel. Especially worrisome are the racist attitudes among large segments of Jewish Israeli youth. Given these attitudes, it is hardly surprising that a year ago today, a young Israeli soldier shot and killed a wounded and defenseless Palestinian. Equally unsurprising, there was a huge outcry in Israel when he was indicted and later convicted of the reduced charge of manslaughter. Press reports from Israel make it clear that many Israelis thought his behavior was justified, and that it was hardly an isolated incident. He simply had the misfortune of getting caught on film. The fact that the shooting was captured on film virtually guaranteed that it would go viral on social media and further damage Israel's image. The bottom line is that the days when Israel was seen as a morally upright David taking on an evil Goliath are over. The damage to Israel's reputation probably started in 1982 when it invaded Lebanon, but it has accelerated at a marked pace over the past decade. The third big change involves changes within the American Jewish community. One of the most important developments in recent years is a shift in the balance of power between the mainstream organizations in the lobby that reflexively support Israel's policies towards the Palestinians and a more progressive set of organizations that are determined to find a way to make peace between the two sides. The divide between those groups has long been present, but the balance of power between them has always been lopsided in favor of the organizations that support Israel no matter what it does. That situation, however, has begun to change, especially with the rise of J Street, which was created in November 2007 as a home for individuals with progressive views on Israel. It not only has a high profile, but it also is willing to criticize Israeli policies in the occupied territories and actually take on the hardline organizations in the lobby. J Street is surely not as powerful as an organization like AIPAC, but the mere fact that it has survived and is thriving shows that times are changing. After all, a similar organization called BRERA was established in 1973, but the mainline forces in the lobby quickly crushed it. Not only has J Street survived, but there is good reason to think that it will grow in strength over time as increasing numbers of American Jews look to join institutions that challenge Israel's repressive policies towards the Palestinians. In addition to these changes in the Jewish establishment, there are changes taking place in the broader American Jewish community that do not bode well for either the lobby or Israel. In particular, it seems clear that younger Jews are not as committed to Israel as their parents and grandparents. For example, a Pew survey from 2013 found that among Jews who are 65 years or older, 53% say that caring about Israel is essential to being what Jewish means to me. That's 65 years or older, 53%. In contrast, 32% of American Jews under the age of 30 held a similar view. That is a gap of 21 percentage points. It seems likely that support for Israel and the American Jewish community, which has been weakening over the past decade, will weaken even more in the years ahead as generational change continues. Lastly, there's been an important change in Israel's support within the United States. For purposes of background, it's important to reemphasize that public support for Israel in the United States has never been particularly strong. One way that the lobby deals with this thin support is to have significant influence both inside the Democratic and Republican parties. In essence, the lobby has worked hard to make sure that Israel enjoys strong bipartisan support and is not strongly backed in one of the major parties, but not the other. The lobby was successful in this regard for a long time. But that bipartisan support has begun to erode over the past decade as support for Israel inside the Democratic Party has plummeted. At the same time, it has grown substantially inside the Republican Party. In a Pew poll from this past January, only 33% of Democrats said they sympathize more with the Israelis than the Palestinians, while 74% of Republicans said they sympathize more with Israel than the Palestinians. This is a gap of 41 percentage points. In short, there has been a marked erosion in support for Israel within the Democratic Party in recent years, which raises serious questions as to whether the lobby will be able to maintain bipartisan support for the special relationship in the years ahead. Let me switch gears again and now focus on what has not changed over the past decade. Three things have not changed. First, the lobby is as powerful as ever. One might be tempted to see the lobby's defeat on the Iran nuclear issue as evidence that its power is waning. But that would be a mistake. The lobby does not win every time, and it is most likely to lose when it is pushing the United States to do something that might get it into a war. The Iran deal fits squarely in that category. Its failure to make a deal with Tehran would have sharply increased the chances that the United States would have attacked Iran's nuclear facilities. Where the lobby almost always wins is on matters relating to the Palestinians and financial support for Israel. The fact that the Obama administration could do virtually nothing to get Israel to move toward a two-state solution, yet still opted to provide Israel with $38 billion in aid over the next decade, is clear evidence that the lobby remains very powerful. It's important to understand that the key to the lobby's success is that it focuses mainly on influencing high-level policymakers and opinion makers, as well as the elites in both political parties, not the rank and file. I noted earlier that there has been a significant decrease in support for Israel within the Democratic Party. The reason that change has had little effect on policy is that the elites in the Democratic Party remain deeply committed to the special relationship. They fear the lobby will target them if there is any evidence they are wavering in their support for Israel. One might think that politicians who are supposed to place the American national interest above the interest of all other countries would stand up to the lobby when it pushes policies that they know are not good for the United States. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates explains why this does not happen. I saw most of Congress as uncivil, incompetent at fulfilling their basic constitutional responsibility, micromanagerial, parochial, hypocritical, egotistical, thin-skinned, and here are the key words, and prone to put self and re-election before country. The second big non-change is that U.S. policy toward Israel remains the same as it has been for the past decade. The special relationship, in other words, is firmly intact. Of course, this continuity is hardly surprising, given that there has been no diminishment in the power of the lobby. As many of you probably remember, there was a brief moment during the recent presidential election where it looked like candidate Trump might favor a more even-handed approach to dealing with Israel and the Palestinians. But he quickly reversed field and made it clear that he would go to great lengths to be even more pro-Israel than President Obama. Naturally, Hillary Clinton made the same pledge. Thus, there's no good reason to think that American policy toward Israel is going to change in a meaningful way anytime soon. Finally, there is hardly any sustained criticism of Israel in the American foreign policy establishment. This, too, is unsurprising, since the lobby is as powerful as ever, and as I emphasized, it focuses most of its attention on keeping the country's elites in line. Anyone who wants to be a serious player in the making of U.S. foreign policy understands full well that if he or she criticizes Israel, there will be a price to pay. The result is that there is no serious debate about Israel or the special relationship in Congress, the mainstream media, or prominent think tanks like the Council on Foreign Relations. This is not to deny, however, that there is an open and vigorous discussion of Israel and its relationship with the United States outside of these establishment institutions. Let me conclude by talking about where we go from here. I believe dark times are ahead for both Israel and the lobby. There's no reason to think Israel is going to move toward a two-state solution. Greater Israel is here to stay, and that state is and will remain an apartheid state. That brute fact will become increasingly clear to people all over the world, especially now that it is clear the Palestinians are not going to get a state of their own. Moreover, the Palestinians, who already comprise almost half of the population of Greater Israel, will continue to resist their oppression, which will force Israel to escalate the repressive policies that have already badly tarnished its image. The Palestinians' most potent weapon in this fight will be BDS, which is a global movement that aims to generate significant economic and political pressure on Israel that will ultimately force it to give the Palestinians equal rights. Israel and its supporters in the West view BDS as an existential threat because it not only has the potential to delegitimize Israel, but it might ultimately lead to Israel's undoing. After all, the Palestinians, if they were given equal rights, Israel would cease to be a Jewish state, as there eventually will be more Palestinians than Jews inside of Greater Israel. And there are good reasons to think that BDS might succeed, at least when it comes to delegitimizing Israel. First, it takes dead aim at apartheid, which is a morally repugnant political system that is universally condemned. Apartheid South Africa eventually disappeared. Why should Israel be any different? Second, the call to give the Palestinians equal rights is fully consistent with basic Western values. It's a demand that will surely resonate in Western Europe and the United States, causing all sorts of problems for Israel and its supporters. Of course, Israel and its supporters are counting on the lobby to stymie BDS. Over time, however, that will become an increasingly difficult task, simply because there is no good defense for apartheid, which is a reprehensible political system. Nevertheless, the lobby is extraordinarily powerful, and it will go to enormous lengths to protect Israel at every turn. It's difficult to say where this conflict will lead in the decades ahead. Many Israelis will surely be interested in expelling the Palestinians from Greater Israel if they have the opportunity, thereby eliminating the need for apartheid. But that outcome is unlikely because there are now more than 6 million Palestinians living within Greater Israel's borders, and they would surely put up fierce resistance if Israel tried to expel them from their homes. Moreover, massive ethnic cleansing would be an enormous and everlasting stain on Israel's reputation. It's more likely that Israel will simply remain an apartheid state and will help, and with the help of the lobby, just hunker down and accept the fact that most of the world considers it a pariah state. Finally, there's the possibility that BDS will carry the day and Greater Israel will become a legitimate liberal democracy. If that were to happen, which is not likely, it would undoubtedly come after much bloodshed, as most Israeli Jews would fervently oppose this outcome, since it would mean the end of the Zionist dream. Again, it's hard to say which one of these outcomes will carry the day. It will probably take another 20 or 30 years before we understand how this conflict will ultimately be resolved, or maybe not resolved. Regardless of the outcome, I am deeply sad to say that the decades ahead promise abundant trouble for Israel and especially for the Palestinians. And the United States will not be spared either, simply because the lobby will be working overtime to protect Israel and preserve the special relationship, which is likely to harm America's intellectual life as well as its politics. Thank you.
Professor John Mearsheimer, University of Chicago professor and co-author of Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, along with co-author Stephen Walt, discussing what, from his vantage point, what he sees as the future of the Israel Lobby, which we commonly call AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. Very interesting name that doesn't really tell what the organization does. You heard him reference several times BDS, and I just want to clarify what that means. It means boycott, divestment, and sanctions. The BDS movement started along the lines of encouraging, just as the situation was with apartheid South Africa, encouraging exactly the same thing, a boycott of South Africa at that time, a boycott and a divestment and sanctions against South Africa. So it has mushroomed into a world or global movement, and it is beginning to make some serious dents in the sure-footed relationship between AIPAC, the lobby group, and people, countries all over the world. And it is seen as perhaps one of the most practical ways to advocate for Palestinians, since Israel has no intention of changing its policies. The question now comes to us and people all over the world. What is our role in all of this? Does it make sense to us to be involved in this at all? And if so, at what level? Or do we just say, well, you know, the lobby seems to have everything under control? I mean, this week, ending tomorrow, in its own public relations postings, it boasts that practically all of the members of Congress would somehow, one way or the other, attend some portion of the conference, the policy conference. A lot of money is on the table, and they want more. Are Americans comfortable enough with the idea that their taxpayer dollars are supporting something that we found objectionable when it applied to South Africa? Or do we just sit back and say, okay, well, you know, somehow they will work things out? Do we have any indications that they will work things out? This is the question. We have some time for some calls. 888-874-4888. So what he's saying is that despite the airtight, or what seems to be an airtight relationship between the lobby group lobbying in behalf of Israel, no matter what, walking away from the table with commitments from the United States of billions of dollars that have no conditions attached to them, and also it's free money. They don't have to pay any of this back. And we don't know where exactly the money is going. But we do know that we see reports about new weapons being purchased, new weapons being used, new tactics being used. And it is not a point of contention at all in Congress. Nobody is upset about it. Nobody has publicly chastised Israel in Congress, not that I know. And the expectation is that it will continue to be so. What do you think should be done about that? Is it a legitimate concern, or is it people having difficulty with the success, the marked success of a lobby group allegedly representing the interests of Israel and Jews across the globe that is doing just a great job. It's getting things done, and people don't like that. So they're critical. Tony from Orlando, what are you thinking?
Hi, Retrieves. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Well, I think that calling Israel an apartheid state is 100% correct. They have reworked the map, the Israeli and Palestinian so-called territory map, to where it's going to be virtually impossible to make a Palestinian state. It's almost like what happened during when Pakistan and India, when Pakistan separated from India, they created an East and West Pakistan, which now today you have Bangladesh. So basically they've created a situation where it's going to be impossible for a Palestinian state to even exist. What I believe needs to happen is that more people need to be come to light to the fact that Israel is an apartheid state. I mean, I've did a little research online, and I've even seen that where Israel used to support South Africa when it was an apartheid state militarily. So there is they do have ties when it comes to that type of thinking. I've also met some Orthodox Jews from Israel, and they have very racist opinions of darker skinned, even of their own Jewish people. I mean, not too recently, they're trying to deport a bunch of Ethiopian Jews. They were more than willing to accept Russian Jews all of these years and Polish Jews. But when it comes to darker skinned Jews, they don't even accept those Jews as being legitimate in Israel. So I think there needs to be an emphasis as to what Israel's real goals are and how they're really treating the Palestinians. People, I don't think, really understand that Palestinians, especially at what they call Arab Israelis, are actually being treated as second-class citizens.
Well, and that is being kind. I know many people who have lived and in some cases still are living in Israel. They are Jews, and they are very, very upset about what has become of their country. And, you know, with all that said, I can't help but project what could happen in this country, the way things are going. It is quite possible that we would see the emergence of several Americas designed by the political imperatives of groups with an incredible amount of power, disproportionate to their numbers. But they nonetheless are utilizing the resources of the public, the taxpayer, to do these kinds of nefarious things. Thanks so much for your call and for getting us started today. Patricia from New York, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, you trees. I hope all is
well. Hello.
And good afternoon to the PRN family. I will definitely see you on Sunday.
Oh, good.
So let me just start by saying, you know, it's funny you should talk about BDS, because there was an article last week in the Times of Israel about how BDS is not is failing across the country, and they talked about across the country and in Europe, and they talked about the fact that especially on college campuses where, you know, the epicenter of the anti-war movement in the 60s and 70s was concentrated on college campuses, and they talked about the fact that BDS was actually dying, and that they were committed to the death of BDS, and they made no – and in the article they talked about making absolutely no apologies about it, and how anyone who even considers supporting BDS, it was an actual threat. I mean, this article was just interesting to read. But, you know, it's not surprising because, you know, let's face it, I mean, I don't know who exported in what direction the racism was exported. But, you know, America has a history of either exporting their racism to other places where they feel that they will find sanctuary, and then once rooted, supported. So what I'm beginning to do is task African-American leadership about why, if we have no money in this country for schools and for health care and for education, why are they continuing to support policies in support of Israel, and certainly in support of these billions of dollars to Israel every year, when right here in this country we have an infrastructure in black and brown communities that has crumbled, not crumbling, but has crumbled. And I'm beginning to ask that question at every forum I attend, and I'm beginning to attend more and more. As a matter of fact, last week at the Schomburg, I questioned one of the politicians from Brooklyn about gentrification. And I mean, he got very upset with me and said that I was misinformed with my information and literally walked away. So I'm beginning to ask black and brown politicians everywhere I go, why? If they are afraid to challenge Israel, say you're afraid.
Now, if you were to carry this argument a little further, how do you see it playing out nationally within the United States when this topic is broached?
Well, you know, outside of those big enclave cities and states, so I'm talking about places like New York and California and Florida, you go into middle America and they don't really know very much about the state of Israel, and they could really care. AIPAC really has its influence, and all the money and support that they're getting really are from limited geographic locations. Most Americans are just not, it's like everything else, they're just not informed. And so, again, the answer is to make certain that everywhere you go, you talk about it and you raise the contradictions so you begin to inform everyone.
How do you think the progressive community is responding? I mean, progressive politicians and leaders.
They're not.
Sanders.
They're not. When it comes to Israel, you see and you feel and you sense the power of AIPAC and the Jewish community. You just do. And so everybody will fall in line, which is why my job now is to begin to challenge them publicly.
Thanks, Patricia, for your call. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I wanted to provide this as a backdrop to what is going to be concluded tomorrow, and we will hear all the spectacular things that have been achieved with your taxpayer dollars. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.